Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's about 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, January the 16th. Should No Child Left Behind be reauthorized? Congress has put off action until later this year, but last week President Bush warned Congress if it does not reauthorize No Child Left Behind, he'll make as many changes as he can on his own.
If it's not reauthorized, then I've instructed our secretary to move forward on some reforms or to analyze reforms that she can do through the administrative process. If Congress passes a bill that weakens the accountability system in the No Child Left Behind Act, I will strongly oppose it and veto it because the act will continue on.
1-800-642-1234. We welcome your thoughts and questions about No Child Left Behind and President Bush's comments about it last week and what changes should or you think should happen to No Child Left Behind. The law requires math and reading tests in grades 3 through 8 and one time in high school. Schools that miss testing benchmarks face increasingly stiff sanctions. If the law is not revised by Congress, the existing law stands. Should it? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We will talk about this with Michael Apple, professor of curriculum and instruction and educational policy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the author of a number of books and most recently the editor, with James Bean, of Democratic Schools, Lessons in Powerful Education. This is the second edition of Democratic Schools. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And indeed, Democratic Schools, the first edition, was out some time ago.
Yes, that's true, and it sold probably about 500,000 copies in various nations, so it became quite a popular book.
Right. It says here that this expanded and updated edition of Democratic Schools arrives at an increasingly relevant time, talking about the stuff like No Child Left Behind. How can Democratic Schools be involved in this issue?
Well, first of all, one of the things that Mr. Bush and others, and this cuts across the political spectrum in many ways, have said is that there is no alternative to what we're doing now. So high-stakes testing, punitive reforms, and we'll put reforms in large neon-lit quotation marks on that, the deprofessionalization of teachers, the loss of local autonomy in many, many states, all of this, we're told, is what has to be done. Unfortunately, in many, many counties, states, cities, rural areas, etc., it's been a failed reform. So part of the task that many of us have tried to engage in is to say, well, if there, you know, are there alternatives? Are there things that are working right now in real schools, in real communities, in real rural and urban and suburban areas? So part of the task of Democratic Schools was for us to be the secretaries of communities and parents and teachers and administrators and the business sector working together to try and make a difference, trying to say, wait a minute, we're being sold a bill of goods here that No Child Left Behind and its progeny are the best. Well, it's not true and it's failing. What would it look like in real terms if we focused on what schools are doing that actually work?
Yeah. Well, can you give us an example of a school that's making it work?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. First, there are five schools that are included in the book. One is in Madison. It's Sherman Middle School, which is a contentious place, but some of the things that are going on are truly remarkable. Fratney Street School in Milwaukee, a vocational and technical high school that had a huge dropout rate in the Boston area. A school set up in Harlem in New York City. And a school near one of the worst housing projects in terms of the conditions that people live in Chicago. So each of these is an attempt to try and show what can be done. So a good example, for instance, would be something like this. in the school in New York, which has now been duplicated in many, many other places, including Boston, students are not conditioned only to respond to the standardized tests, but they do use tests, but they have portfolios, students give performances, they document by actual ways in which they work how well they understand the material. They have mentors among the teachers, class sizes are somewhat smaller, artists are brought in to work in the school. So these kinds of reforms that we know have worked for the last 100 years are then taken out and put all in one spot. So these are the kinds of things we're talking about.
Yeah. Well, let me get your thoughts on what President Bush said last week, that if Congress doesn't reauthorize No Child Left Behind, he'll make the changes he thinks are needed by himself.
Well, Mr. Bush, and not only him, that is, this again cuts across the political landscape, presidents in the past that have not gotten their way have historically tried very, very hard through extrajudicial forms or by just changing administrative codes to get their own way. President Bush has been much more aggressive about this, and it's only in the last year, well, not even year, since the Republicans basically lost the last election, for Congress, for instance, he's tried very, very hard to use his bully pulpit to threaten certain kinds of things. My own sense is that he will act on this. He's a bit of an ideologue when it comes to education. And he's been listening to people, I think, who, while they may be well-intentioned, actually have very, very little understanding of what's going on in places like Milwaukee, or Madison, or Racine, or Philadelphia, or Atlanta, etc. So unfortunately, I think what will happen is he will push very, very hard to get even stronger accountability measures publicly at the same time that he's backing away from some of the worst kinds of punitive forms. Let me give an example. Mm-hmm. Right now, No Child Left Behind says the following. If somehow I am an extraordinarily talented group of teachers with the help of many parents and others in a community, and I had a huge decline in test scores over a five-year period because the economy fell apart in my community, my test scores averaged 40 out of a possible 100. And teachers and communities and kids worked very, very hard, and I got the average up to 65, a 25-point gain. That doesn't count. It doesn't count at all. Matter of fact, even though you've made massive gains in a 1 or 2 year period, this you're still called a failing school. So one of the things that the commissioner of education, secretary of education, mm-hmm. Spelling has tried now is to be a little more flexible and say, well, we'll now try and give you some flexibility. So if you make massive gains, we'll count it. You'll still be failing, but we'll look at you more nicely. Mm-hmm. So he's backing away in private about these kinds of things. But again, I think the bully pulpit, he wants to look strong over education. It's largely rhetorical. Most places from both right, center, and left are now in agreement that parts of this law are basically broken.
Yeah, so he said if Congress sends him a bill that weakens accountability that he would veto it. What is it that critics want to see happen with this accountability standard?
Okay, well, let me take as one example the one that I just gave. That is, right now, unless you make adequate yearly progress, and by the year 2014, supposedly 100% of all schools and 100% of all kids will meet those arbitrarily determined standards that, by the way, were not always determined democratically, there is an attempt right now to try and say, well, we must still push for test scores that are extraordinarily expensive. That's about $20 per student, and we have about 40 million tests that are given. So you do the metric on that. That's a lot of money we're spending on testing. So he wants even more testing. We know right now what is happening. So the tests, by the way, in many ways turn teachers into basically test teaching machine. So the tail of the test wags the dog of the teacher. Mm-hmm. And in places like Texas, where this stuff got started, one of the things we're finding is that teachers spend almost all their time teaching for reductive tests in, say, math and reading, and that's all that's tested, though science will come in this coming year. And kids who are poor often in poorly funded schools almost never get literature, science, social studies, etc. It's just not tested, and all they're doing is doing test prep. Now, he feels that the only measure of accountability, not just him, but the entire administration, the only measure of accountability would be these tests. I know of almost no practicing educators, no matter what their political affiliations, who believe that that's the case. So he wants more of it. Most people who are thoughtful about this want to lessen the emphasis on these standardized tests.
We're talking with Michael Apple, a professor of curriculum and instruction and educational policy at UW-Madison, author of a number of books, most recently the second edition of Democratic Schools, Lessons in Powerful Education. Professor Apple, talking with us about some of the ideas in his book, Democratic Schools, but also on the latest on No Child Left Behind. And President Bush last week urging Congress to reauthorize No Child Left Behind and threatening to veto any anything that Congress sends him that weakens accountability standards when it comes to No Child Left Behind. What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon on Talk of the Nation, the political junkie will join Neil Conan talking about the latest in political news, including the results of the Michigan primary yesterday, what's coming ahead, the debate last night in Nevada. The political junkie on Talk of the Nation this afternoon after 1 o'clock. We're talking about No Child Left Behind, and some comments President Bush had last week, saying that if Congress doesn't reauthorize the No Child Left Behind education law, he will make as many changes as he can on his own. He also said if Congress does renew the law but weakens it in the process, he would veto it. We're talking with Professor Michael Apple about No Child Left Behind, and we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for him. What's good about No Child Left Behind, if anything? What's bad about it? Tina in Cecil. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, Tina.
Basically, I don't think that the act works, and I think that President Bush's comments in regards to it just demonstrate his inflexibility and his characteristic refusal to look at reality. I agree with the comments of the guests. I mean, even if we thought that this worked, I mean, it needs to be modified. If President Bush's position shows that he's incapable of looking at what's working and what's not working. I have three special needs kids, and this has not helped them at all.
Yeah, why do you say it hasn't helped him?
Basically, I mean, additional testing doesn't work. Punitive measures toward school districts doesn't work. I mean, they don't have the money to provide the needs of special needs kids, let alone to be doing all this testing, which is basically teachers teaching for testing.
Yeah.
I mean, on so many levels, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, thank you, Tina. Professor Apple?
I think Tina speaks for many, many parents, and many parents of special needs children in particular. And rhetorically, the act is wise. That is, what it says, what it reminds us, and this is what I think its positive moment, is, look, let's stop ignoring kids who are special needs kids who are, say, children of color, impoverished children, children where English is a second or sometimes even a third language. This is wise rhetorically, but what it does is actually install very, very punitive measures, and basically it's an unfunded mandate. So if you look at the data on how much it costs to put it into place, let's say in one state it might be $1.5 billion in a large state. The extra money that comes in, supposedly, is about $500 million. So it's an incredibly expensive system of checks and accountability mechanisms that have not proven successful. Well, that money has to come somewhere. Often it comes from Title I, that is special programs. And what you get then is a situation in which we spend a huge amount of money on testing, and less money gets put in place for the kinds of things that actually work. So I think that what we're seeing is increasingly, because the rhetoric is taken as reality, the unfunded mandate is then taken as something that's always good for all kids. And I think that Tina's accurate about what's happening in many, many situations.
Thanks very much, Tina, for the call. Senator Edward Kennedy still defends No Child Left Behind, though he does say he sees changes that need to be made. But it seems that he's just upset that there isn't adequate funding for this.
Well, I'm actually right in front of me are some of the quotes that he had from the Washington Post. So he says let me just quote. I'm now channeling Senator Kennedy. Mm-hmm. I quote, "The process for rating troubled schools fails to reward incremental progress," as mm-hmm. I said before. Mm-hmm. "We need to encourage more local decision-making. The act doesn't support teachers as professionals. It fails to deal with the dropout crisis. It doesn't involve parents enough in helping their children succeed. It doesn't have smaller classes. It law fails to supply essential resources." Mm-hmm. So this is what we usually call, I'm now no longer channeling Senator Kennedy, mm-hmm. but there's a difference between standards and what might be called opportunity to learn standards, which is this. We hold schools accountable, supposedly, for these test scores at the same time as the budget never keeps up with social needs. Let's take as an example some of the cities that have been deindustrialized, partly in Wisconsin. Wisconsin justifiably has been very, very proud of the number of students who do well on tests and who do well and go on to the university system at whatever level. In many of the cities that were heavily industrial, as factories, because of competition, moved to Mexico or China, etc., the unemployment rate skyrocketed, families fell apart, mental health issues arose, school achievement went down. Well, the answer to this is not to throw more tests and accountability at this. What we're asking schools to do is to be social workers, feeders, clothers, etc., to deal with all of the social problems. And then we blame them when kids make a decision that says, there's no jobs for me out there. Why would I do well in school when all I'm doing is test prep? So in many ways, what we're getting is a situation in which rather than dealing with the depth of the problem, saying, can schools do it all by themselves? Why are we blaming all of this on this one institution when, in fact, it's quite an unequal system? So, unfortunately, one of the things that we're forgetting about is what is behind some of Kennedy's intuitions, and that is what I call opportunity to learn standards. I'll give one example. The New York Times this morning, in its education section, has a long article, actually quite a clear one, about a secondary school in New York that was built for 1,800 folks. It now has 4,000. Teachers are teaching in classrooms where the roof leaks, and a teacher is teaching with an umbrella. Now, that's quite remarkable. Mm-hmm. So the assumption that simply by having more accountability will fix all this stuff is living in a world so totally divorced from reality, it's actually a tragedy. It's almost like a sort of a Shakespearean drama that is both tragedy and comedic at the same time.
Chris in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I see that No Child Left Behind is another tool of enslavement by the powerful over the rest of us. By keeping kids learning while never thinking, you can keep them from questioning authority, and that's why there's no testing for private schools. The schools for the rich are training leaders, and the religious schools are already teaching respect of authority and not questioning of authority. And I think you find this in authoritarian governments through history.
Your reaction to that, Professor Apple?
Well, I think that it does document the anger that many people have about what's going on to their children. And as I mentioned, this does cut across political affiliations increasingly. Let me give an example of from Democratic schools, of a school in Madison that is trying to actually encourage kids to think critically, but also who will do well on the tests. Unfortunately, we've lost the battle. I don't like that, but we've lost the battle about the increasing number of tests in schools. I'd like there to be fewer tests, and I'd like them to be formed as much at the local level as possible, but we've lost part of that battle. So the idea is to try and find things that generate for teachers and students truly powerful kinds of things that cause them to reflect and think, and at the same time, don't put the kids at risk of failing. So in Madison right now at Sherman School, the learning coordinator is Barbara Brodhagen, one of the most talented educators I've ever met. And in the classrooms, in many of the classrooms, what they're doing is to have units based on student-generated themes. Now, this is not fluff in any way. It is the most disciplined kind of education you can have. And the idea is to integrate mathematics, reading, literature, science, etc., into coherent things around powerful subjects that students want to learn. Issues of money and the economy. Who am I? What is it like to be poor? What is it like to not have a life where you have any future? And to bring these areas of studying it through history, studying it through mathematics, etc., to coordinate that in a very powerful way, and at the same time to have the students deeply involved in presenting their data to each other, being rigorously scrutinized about whether they're disciplined in doing that. Now, that takes time. What you're getting then is a combination in which students are learning a huge amount of stuff that sticks to their ribs because mm-hmm. it's of interest to them. And at the same time, when the tests are given, they're doing pretty darn well. Now, that's a very different model than you would find in many of the No Child Left Behind affiliated forms that mm-hmm. say, here's the test. You're going to master this stuff by just doing reductive test prep day after day after day, especially for poor kids. And then you'll do well on the test, but you're not going to get anything else than that. And then when you get to high school and you're supposed to know all this stuff, you fail. So the response, it seems to me, that's more adequate and a response to what the caller talks about is what we call a more powerful education that gets kids involved. And we will guarantee in many ways that they will do no worse and often much, much better than the reductive forms that are called many children left behind.
You can read more about what Sherman Middle School in Madison is up to, what it's doing, as well as other schools around the country in the book, the second edition, Democratic Schools, Lessons in Powerful Education. Our guest is the co-editor of this book, Michael Apple. He's a professor of curriculum and instruction and educational policy at UW-Madison. We're talking with him about this book, Democratic Schools, but in particular talking about President Bush's comments last week about No Child Left Behind, saying that if Congress doesn't reauthorize it, he will make as many changes as he can on his own. And he also said if Congress weakens the accountability part of the education law, that he would veto that. The No Child Left Behind law requires math and reading tests in grades 3 through 8, and once in high school, schools that miss testing benchmarks face increasingly stiff sanctions. Dwight in Beloit is next. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, yes, thank you. Good morning. I just have a couple of quick comments about two things that your guest mentioned. One is the smaller class size being an advantage. But in talking with several staff members of the state DPI, they tell me that the evaluation of those programs shows that the result is a big fat zero. There really is no improvement at all. And then the other comment had to do with the $20 for testing. And we spend something on the order of $12,000 per student per year in Wisconsin, even though our graduation rate is below the national average. So the $20 or $40, whatever it would be, to find out how we're doing, that seems like just common sense.
Professor Apple?
Well, I would raise some questions about the caller's comments about the SAGE program and other programs, that it's a big fat zero. The data actually do not indicate that at all, and I wonder to whom he's speaking. There is no doubt that smaller class sizes will be more expensive, and there's no doubt at all that it's not a panacea. So I agree with him on that. That is, I would never want to overstate the fact that just like No Child Left Behind says, more testing will lead to this utopian school system. them, that smaller class sizes are part of a solution. They're not the solution itself. But the data, there's research going on right now at the university on this, and in no way does it show that it's zero. What it does show, by the way, is that voucher plans, etc., show less, and other kinds of privatization initiatives, which are part of No Child Left Behind, by the way. One thing we have not talked about is it's a compromise that leaves the door open with a truck that could go through it, a double-wide trailer, towards privatization, that smaller class sizes show more robust results in achievement than things like privatizing initiatives. His point about the money, I partly agree with. That is, we do in Wisconsin spend a good deal on schools. We should be proud of that. Money is not the only answer, but the question is, when we're spending a huge amount of money and then we're adding more money for more accountability, but it doesn't work, the devil is in the details. That is, so if that is $20 per student per test wasted, that adds up to a huge amount of funding. Now, this does raise the issue of school funding, and this is a very vexed issue.
Mm-hmm.
We do know, for instance, that the way that we fund schools throughout the United States through property taxes basically broke. For wealthy districts, it's a little painful. For poor districts, it's a disaster. And this has paralyzed the legislature for as long as I think there's been schools. But again, we can't have good education on the cheap. If we are asking schools to compensate for the rest of society, we have to ask who's going to pay for it. So let me give an example of this. When I first came to Wisconsin to teach at the university in the early 70s, the corporate sector and the business community paid a much larger share of school taxes than they do now. Now, I fully understand that the corporate sector and the business sector is in a real crisis economically right now, and that the competitive impulses internationally with the global economy make it very, very difficult to keep your business alive. So I have some sympathy with this situation. But basically what we've done is evacuate, as there are more and more tax breaks to businesses, some of them required, some of them perhaps not, that is dumped on the local homeowner, the small business person, and renters. So we are trying in many ways to try and build a school system and defend it in a time of real economic crisis on the cheap. And the people paying for it often are the people who are least able to pay for it. So the issue of money, when that door is open, we have to be very, very honest about, can we do it cheaply? I don't think so. Can we do it in a way where the most of the funding comes from the people who are least able to afford it? I don't think that's fair either.
Yeah, an email from Saul in Stevens Point, which I'm going to edit a little bit here. He said, back when No Child Left Behind came about, I was happy to see attempts to create and test for national standards in literacy and basic science and math, even though it was promoted by a guy, President Bush, who... he does not agree with on most occasions. So he says, I am in the lousy position of defending the No Child Left Behind program, although I detest the president's stand on almost every other issue. We need national standards. We need more federal support for education, and we need testing to measure our progress. You want to respond to that?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to be misunderstood. I am not opposed to testing at all. But if the only measure is this kind of test, we know that it has failed. I am not opposed to the formation of national standards if they are done democratically, if they come from below, not above. And the democratic discussion over those has not gone on. And let's give an example. The state of Utah, which is one of the reddest states in the history of the world in some ways, its legislature had to be cajoled, compromised with. Spelling went there. Margaret Spelling, the Secretary of Education, went there multiple times to keep them from, as a Republican and conservative state, from rejecting any funding from No Child Left Behind because of the nature of the loss of local control over standards, over accountability, etc. So This is what I mean about rhetorically, No Child Left Behind was wise, and it's one of the reasons that it got through Congress. It does say we must establish some mechanism of understanding whether we're doing well in schools. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine anyone disagreeing with having some sense of accountability about that. But let's remember that what this did for many, many school districts was create this subterfuge. Take Houston as an example, where our former Secretary of Education, Mr. Page, said we have no dropouts in Houston. Well, what Houston did in order to make its schools look good for the tests was to place a huge number of non-English-speaking children and Latino and African-American students in another track called the GED track. That is, they were no longer on track to be getting a degree in the 4 or 5 years that it usually requires to get a degree from secondary schools in Houston. Now, the students didn't know this, but that meant that they didn't have to take the test. Well, simple mathematics shows that if you basically engage in subterfuge and take your poorest scoring children out of the pool, your test scores are going to go up quite an immense amount. So what the accountability measures did, by and large, then, was to create pressure on schools to engage in all kinds of subterfuge. Now, the word accountability is actually a very important one. In English, and in Spanish, actually, one of the other major languages in the United States, there are two meanings of accountability. One is to count, to give numbers, that is, to have test scores. Another is to give an account, that is, to tell a story. And one of the problems with No Child Left Behind is we want accountability, but we forget that it has a double meaning. So that what we don't hear are the voices of students, we don't hear the voices of teachers or administrators, all we hear are the numbers. Mm. And that's a disaster. So I'm in favor of accountability, but I want that second sense as strong as the first sense.
Our guest is Michael Apple, Professor of Curriculum and Instruction and Educational Policy at UW-Madison, talking with us about No Child Left Behind. Michael Apple, also the author of a number of books, and most recently the editor of the second edition of Democratic Schools, Lessons in Powerful Education. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn is with you, and Kathleen and her guests will talk some more about No Child Left Behind and focus in on all of the education policies of the presidential candidates. So talking about presidential candidates and education policies and No Child Left Behind coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking with UW-Madison Professor Michael Apple about No Child Left Behind, focusing in some on President Bush's comments last week, saying that if Congress doesn't reauthorize the No Child Left Behind education law, he will make as many changes as he can on his own. He also said that if Congress renews the law but weakens the accountability portion of the law, test scores and the like, he would veto it. So we're talking about what changes Congress might make to No Child Left Behind, what changes should be made to No Child Left Behind, and welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest. And our next caller is Bridget in Delavan. Hi, Bridget.
Hi. My question was, would some of those authentic assessments, like the portfolios or the journals, do you think that they would be able to change some of the you know, assessment questions to focusing on assessments such as those? And what can we do as parents to influence a change towards those more authentic assessments? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Professor Apple?
Well, for those listeners who don't have a familiarity with words like authentic assessment, let me just say something about them. Authentic assessments are similar to those things I talked about that are going on, say, in Sherman School or in New York and many of the schools that we discuss in democratic schools. And these are assessments that go beyond simple numbers of test scores. That is, they ask students, for instance, to think critically, to write essays, to perform certain kinds of tasks that demonstrate that they actually do understand stuff in depth. And they've been quite successful in many, many places, in many schools. And most of the democratic schools we talk about use them, though, again, they don't shy away from fairly rigorous testing at the same time. I tend to be a supporter of authentic assessment. I think that it's wise. And one of the things that these kinds of assessments do is that they document a much broader range of stuff. Let me give an example. Basically, we can talk about three kinds of knowledge that we want kids to have. The shorthand for that is that, how, and to. Mm-hmm. That means we want kids to know facts like Madison is the capital of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. We also want them to have what are called hows, that is to be able to figure out where to find the information. So they know how to go to the library, get on the internet, et cetera, to ask, what's the capital of Wisconsin? Mm-hmm. That's more important. That is, facts tend to be forgotten, but the ideas of how to find information are actually more important. And then two is what we might call values and dispositions. And those are things like they really want to be intellectually open-minded. They want to challenge things. They're critical. They don't simply accept something because somebody in power says it. Now, those are the most important things that we want schools to do, but we want schools to do all three of them. Most of the assessments that we have now simply test recall. They test factual knowledge. Those are the cheapest to give. They're bubble scored. That is, they're the kinds of things you have a number two pencil, and they're machine graded. That's what No Child Left Behind does. The more important things, hows and twos, are the things that most parents also want their kids to be involved in. It's one of the reasons, for instance, that religious schooling and some homeschooling has grown so rapidly in the United States, because people feel as if some issues of values, etc., are being ignored. So, again, this cuts across political affiliations. Now, my sense is that the more we get into the hows and the twos, the better the school will be. Now, it's for these reasons that it's the reductive, boring, and sometimes quite tragic focus on sort of low-level recall that people like Jonathan Kozol, the National Book Award winner and I think one of the best critical journalists, basically the novelist of children's lives, who's been on many of the shows on radio here.
Right. Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons he engaged in a fast against No Child Left Behind, as someone who's deeply connected to parents and local communities and to teachers throughout the United States and the world, he was so distressed by what was going on in schools as he watched kids literally, we might want to not use the word drop out, but get pushed out by mm-hmm. the boredom of schools, by the lack of respect for them as people, that he basically did the following. He said, I will go on a fast, the hunger strike, taking basically only the nutrients and juice, etc., for close to 70 or 80 days until people begin to listen about what is going on with No Child Left Behind and its loss of the sense of the authentic understandings that we want teachers and parents and kids to cherish.
Yeah.
He finally met with Senator Kennedy, and it's after that meeting that Senator Kennedy actually began to be much more flexible and to realize that there are major dangers with No Child Left Behind in its present form. So it's not just this parent who is called or the person who is called who's very worried about this. Many of the most thoughtful educators and most thoughtful commentators, brilliant people in terms of their writing, have also taken this on board and made some quite graphic taken some quite graphic actions to bring this to our attention.
Thank you, Bridget. Joe in La Crosse is with us now. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. I just wanted to comment. For the most part, I couldn't agree more with much of what your guest proposes. But one of the things I wanted to take issue is with the fact that a couple moments ago he said, we have to stop doing education on the cheap. And I've been looking around, but I don't see anything that was cheap about education over the last 40 years, as we've continued to spend more and more and more, though it doesn't always seem that the corresponding results came about. One of the things that I'm curious as to his thoughts about is, as well, is the imbalance in educational funding, and by that I'm referring to the fact that the per-pupil expenses for a state, how can they be so dramatically different? How can we simply accept that we're going to pay the schools based on what we collect locally? How is it that children are worth more in some parts of the state than they are in others? How is it that schools have truckloads of money in some parts of the state? Minnesota's a perfect example if you're in Edina, Eden Prairie, in that area, because the property values are so intense. And the schools with fewer people in the areas, and with, you know, the inner city schools, they're kind of second rate. They're not quite so important to us. I think that borders on the criminal, and I think we need to stop it, and we need to change it, and we need to do that first, because we have to start with the understanding that all of the kids in our schools are equally important, and all of the kids in our schools are equally deserving of the funding and the attention that we're putting into this. And then we need to realize that like your guest has said, tests don't tell us what students are doing. Tests tell us what schools are doing in order to make it look like what the students are doing.
It seems to me that Jonathan Kozol wrote a lot about that inequity too, didn't he?
Exactly. I couldn't agree more with what the caller has just said. On his first point, I don't want to say at all that simply throwing more money into a machine is going to fix everything. We have to ask, does the money get to the classroom? Often it does not. It's not just the testing of No Child Left Behind. It's the immense accountability and administrative structure that goes with it. You need people to make certain that all these things are done well. And a huge amount of money, as one of my colleagues, Tricia Birch, has documented, a huge amount of money from No Child Left Behind is coming out of schools now and going into private corporations for tutoring, for test prep, for accountability mechanisms. So we may be spending more money, but a huge amount of it never gets to the school or to the classroom. Now, the second issue that he raises that I think was just incredibly articulate is one I totally agree with. This society is organized around issues of race and class and gender. We live in a society in which if you are black or brown or Hmong, as an example, and poor, your children will get much less health care. They will get fewer resources. In many of the inner cities in the United States, children are being taught, and I say this knowing exactly what I'm saying, in toilets. That is, the schools are in such disarray and disrepair that you have reading classes being taught in the men's room because there are no other rooms that don't leak. If we were to be honest, for instance, about the differential funding in Wisconsin, we know quite clearly from government reports that the disparities in funding are tragic, and Wisconsin is considered one of the best states. We know that Wisconsin has among the highest rates of child poverty in the entire United States. We have the highest rates of incarceration as well, of people of color among most of the states in the United States. So unless we take that seriously, we actually will fail. And this is exactly the point I was trying to get at when we say we are asking schools to do everything. And the more responsibility you put on schools, the more expensive it's going to be. It is not cheap at all. And for kids who have a very bleak future, equality is not spending the same amount on them as kids whose parents have a huge amount of economic and cultural capital. It's spending more. So I would actually prefer that we reverse the polls on this. The poorer you are, the more you get, the more we have to compensate for the life chances that have been denied you. And, Wisconsin has, in fact, had not the most positive history around issues of race and impoverishment over the last century in many ways.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Lots of other callers. Phil in Peshtigo, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I love in your program. I actually live in Florida. I'm on my way back home. Had to come up and get to that Packer game.
Go ahead.
My granddaughter came to me one day, and she was terrified, and she said, Grandpa, I've got to study for the SAT. The only thing they are teaching is, in the classroom, is pounding and pounding and pounding, so everybody passes the SAT, and just like you said, for the numbers, not for the quality of education. And then I have a grandson who he's got problems in school because he's terribly bored, because everything is brought down to different levels. Now, there is some structuring in Florida, which I'm working on getting him, you know, more challenging classes. But the numbers game is killing our education system. I couldn't say more, and thank you very much. I'm really enjoying this program.
Well, Phil, thanks very much for the call. Welcome back to Wisconsin. Professor Apple?
Well, one of the reasons that we did democratic schools and tried to act as the secretaries for people who were doing powerful things was exactly these kinds of issues that the caller points to. That is, if you want kids to do well, you can't bore them to death. Imagine what it would be like if you are an adult now and I were to tell you you're going to sit in a classroom for 6 hours a day, sometimes 8 hours a day, sometimes even more if you're getting the other kinds of test prep things after school, since the tests are coming up. And you're going to sit there and do nothing but worksheets and test prep for 180 days a year. I think you would be suicidal by the end of the first month. So part of our task was to try and say, look, we all want high-achieving kids. What is going on in schools right now that actually answers the questions and the worries that this caller speaks to?
Yeah. With our final moment here or two, Professor Apple, do you have any idea what Congress might do when it comes to No Child Left Behind?
I think it's up for grabs. Right now, the president is grandstanding. I'm not certain that, I must admit, I don't know. When I've spoken to people in Washington and I've spoken to people in the state, they don't know either. There's all kinds of backroom deals going on. My hunch is that No Child Left Behind will be reauthorized. There will be some changes, some of them quite serious. That is, credit for progress, as an example. Mm-hmm. More local control. But by and large, I think that No Child Left Behind and its basic framework will remain because the Republicans and Democrats hardly speak to each other. That's a tragedy, but in many ways I think that it's become so politicized, and I think that's correct that it should be politicized, but I don't see anything coming out of this that will radically transform this. So what we may get is a stopgap reauthorization with some changes, but certainly not enough, I think, to make a major difference, unfortunately.
Well, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us, and good luck with the second edition of Democratic Schools.
Thanks, Joy. It's a pleasure.
Michael Apple, Professor of Curriculum and Instruction and Educational Policy at UW-Madison. He is the editor with James Bean of Democratic Schools, Lessons in Powerful Education, recently re-released, or the second edition just released. Thanks to Karen Prager and Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.